You are listening to a Commonwealth Bank of Australia Global Economic and Markets Research Podcast. This podcast provides general market-related information and is not intended to be an investment research report. The information contained in this podcast is based on previously published material, and before listening, you're advised to read the full Global Economic and Markets Research disclaimers, which can be found at combankresearch.com.au.
Welcome to the CommBank Global Economic and Markets Research Podcast. My name is Belinda Allen and I'm a senior economist here at CommBank. And now we're going to do things a little bit differently in this podcast. We're going to have two guests this week. So my first guest will be Christina Clifton, also a senior economist here at CommBank. And we're going to be talking about how the various state economies may perform during the COVID-19 outbreak and also how they may recover. And then I'm going to be joined by Joseph Caperso, our head of international economics, and he'll be giving us an update on how the global economy is performing. And also we're going to dive into the Chinese economy and how the trade relations are going around the world, particularly with the US and China. Now, as I said, joining me first is Christina Clifton. Now, you've just published a report on looking at the differences in performance that we can expect through the various state economies in Australia during the coronavirus period and as we come out of it. Now, we all know the Australian economy is going to contract very sharply in the second quarter of 2020 and over the whole of 2020 as we're going through stopping the transmission of the coronavirus. When you looked at each of the state economies, what ones do you think will outperform and which ones do you think will underperform?
Okay, Belinda, yeah, so you have mentioned that we are expecting a weak performance for the Australian economy as a whole. So we'll start by saying we're expecting a weak performance for all the states and territories, with that main hit being felt in the June quarter. Having said that, we think some states and territories will fare worse than others. So we're expecting Victoria to underperform by the most. Also New South Wales, we're also expecting a relatively large contraction for New South Wales as well. We think the ACT won't be too far behind Victoria and New South Wales in terms of the size of the contraction. But on the other side of the coin, we think the mining states of WA and the Northern Territory won't experience as large a contraction. And we also think that Tasmania will do a little better than the average as well.
So when you're looking at the different factors that will really drive performance of the states, you've kind of looked at education, particularly foreign students, you've looked at tourism, you've looked at migration, and of course how each state government is dealing with the social distancing and economic shutdown measures. What was really at the top of the list when you thought about what was the major factor that's going to drive performance? Was there one in particular, or I guess was it a series of different factors that's driving the outperformance or underperformance?
Yeah, I think one of the major factors that's going to be driving performance in different states and territories is just those, first of all, that restriction put in place to stop the spread of the virus by closing Australia's borders. So Australia has a very large inflow of foreign students and tourists and also people just coming into our country to work, and that drives population growth here in Australia. It's different for the different states and territories. We find that New South Wales and Victoria take a relatively large share of these foreign students and also foreign tourists relative to the size of their economies. So that's definitely a factor that's going to weigh heavily on New South Wales and Victoria. On the other hand, we look at WA. They have relatively low population growth. WA also doesn't take a lot of students or foreign tourists relative to the size of their economy. They're more exposed to the mining sector. So in that sense, WA would be less affected by that closing down of the borders. Also, you mentioned, Belinda, the restrictions in place by the different state and territory governments. They're going to have, or they are having and going to have, a big impact on how heavily hit each state is hit and how fast they recover. We have seen Victoria putting in place relatively tight restrictions, and we're now seeing them lift them quite slowly compared to some of the other states and territories. So that's another real driving factor behind the underperformance that we expect to see in Victoria.
Now, just going back to the foreign students, obviously we did see Australia effectively shut its borders, you know, progressively to some countries first and then to all foreign nationals at the end of March. That has certainly locked out a significant share of the foreign student markets. Are there any states that are particularly exposed in terms of foreign students? Do any states really rely on education exports more so than other states?
Yes, definitely New South Wales and Victoria are very much more exposed to foreign tourists. So just in terms of the numbers, we know that New South Wales takes almost 40% of foreign students, and that compares to its share of economy of around 33%. Again, for Victoria, Victoria takes about 34% of foreign students and only accounts for about 24% of the economy. So both these states are much more heavily exposed to the, you know, to the closing down of the borders and that slow down in foreign tourist and student numbers than some of the other states and territories.
And we have heard from the state premiers that they have different timelines for reopening each state to domestic tourism. Obviously, foreign tourism is well and truly off the radar, you know, probably for much of 2020, but certainly domestic tourism could come back a little bit earlier. When we look at the tourism share of each economy, we do know that Australians generally spend more offshore than foreign tourists spend onshore. Does that really impact the different states? Are any states in particular more exposed to domestic tourism versus foreign tourism?
Yeah, so what we see in the data is that New South Wales and Victoria are relatively underweight domestic tourism, but the other states, and in particular Queensland, take a larger share of domestic tourism. And as you mentioned, Belinda, Australians tend to spend more overseas than what foreigners spend here in Australia. So if we really see those border restrictions start to lift and we start to see Australians travelling a lot more domestically, spending the money that they would have spent overseas domestically instead, that could really provide a support to the economy. In particular, those destinations like Queensland, also Tasmania, is a very popular destination for domestic tourists as well. So they could really get a boost once borders are open domestically and that domestic tourism activity is allowed to take place again.
Now that will certainly be very promising for the economic outlook. Now, just before we finish, I just wanted to talk about the weekly card spend data that we produce. Now, when we look at that on a state basis, has that really helped define, you know, how state economies are performing at the moment? Do you find that the economic shutdown measures and the social restrictions are coming through in that weekly card spend?
Yeah, we are definitely seeing some divergences in that spending data by state. So once again, New South Wales, Victoria and the ACT, spending is still quite weak in those three jurisdictions. But in the other parts of Australia, so WA, South Australia, the Northern Territory and Tasmania, spending growth rates are a lot stronger. So it looks like, you know, Victoria's been hit by, you know, the loss of foreign students and the loss of foreign tourists. They've also really been affected by tighter restrictions to slow the spread of the virus, and we're seeing that definitely in our card spending data.
And overall, though, we have seen some improved momentum in the card spend data. It looks like the trough was really in mid-April, and since then we certainly have seen some improvement come through, and that this is one of the data sources that we're relying on quite heavily to look at how the COVID-safe economy might be performing. Appreciate your time today, Christina.
Thanks, Linda.
Joining me now is Joseph Capurso, our Head of International Economics. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Belinda.
So I've just been talking to Christina about how the Australian economy, and particularly the performance of the different state economies, is going to go. Now, we're going to have a talk about how the global economy is going, particularly if we're starting to see any signs of recovery come through. It looks like here in Australia, that April was the real weak point in terms of the economic contraction. How is May tracking in some of the main economies that you are monitoring?
So, look, the May economic data is showing a recovery in most of the major economies that we cover. For example, the European Purchasing Managers Indices have certainly bounced back up from their very, very low record levels recorded in April. However, the bounce back was only modest, and the levels of these indicators remain very, very weak and certainly consistent with the recession extending into May.
And in the US, we've obviously saw, you know, the very sobering April labour market report where we saw a bit over 20 million people lose their job. How is the US economy tracking? Because there's been a lot of focus on the number of cases in the US and also the interplay with the desire to ease restrictions taking place. How is the economic data tracking in the US?
So now that the lockdowns are being eased in the US and in a number of other economies, you are seeing an improvement in some of the US economic data. For example, initial jobless claims, they peaked at 6 million and now they're travelling around 2 to 3 million per week. And these are still very, very high numbers, but they are showing somewhat of an improvement in the US economy. But we don't expect a quick turnaround back to normal levels of economic activity in any economy, including the US, because some businesses will not reopen and the unemployment rate, well, that's going to take many years to return back down to the 2019 levels.
I mean, that's very similar to Australia as well, even though the Australian infection numbers are, you know, well under control and the economy is opening up even sooner than what we thought, we still have the unemployment rate above 7% in June 2022. So it's a very slow fall in the unemployment rate here. What other high-frequency data are you watching quite closely? You are producing a daily coronavirus tracker looking at some key economic data worldwide. What are some of the particular data pieces that you're watching quite closely?
Well, the most important high-frequency data point remains new virus infections. And that is showing a worrying trend in some of the larger emerging market economies, such as Russia and Brazil. Even in the US, infections are falling, but the decline is very narrowly based in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Outside of those three states, coronavirus infections are tracking around 20,000 per day. So it's still quite elevated, hasn't come down very much from the peaks that we saw a month or two ago outside of those three states in the US Northeast. Now, in terms of the economic data, the most important economic data points to follow in the US, as you mentioned, were those jobless claims and the insured unemployment rate, which is the unemployment rate for every week. You've also got mortgage applications. They're bumping around a bit as well in America. Weekly retail sales in the US are incredibly weak. As is the New York Fed's weekly economic index. It's almost three times worse than what we saw during the GFC. Over in China, the economic data that we're following are daily property sales, weekly car sales. Both of those indicators have showed reasonable recoveries, getting back towards normal levels. We're also looking at subway traffic and box office revenue, and that's more or less dead in the water in China. But some of the other indices, such as subway traffic, have been recovering, which is a good sign.
Now, you made that transition very easy for me. I was going to actually turn our attention to China, but you already did it. Now, we did see over the weekend that and last Friday that China held their National People's Congress, which was delayed. Now, for the first time in a while, they did not set a GDP target. How significant was that?
Yeah, look, it is significant. They've been having a government work report for literally decades. Now, the reason they didn't have an economic growth target this time round was simply the uncertainty about the impact of the coronavirus on the economy. Now, you contrast that with, say, central banks, which are generally putting out their own forecast for the impact of their own economy. So they do stand out for being different to other economies. The government work report also downgraded the employment growth target from 11 million every year for the last few years to 9 million this year. So that is a reasonable step down in their expectations for the Chinese economy for this year. But don't make the mistake that the lack of an economic growth target means they're ignoring their economy. But the Chinese government certainly is not doing that. And they're still supporting their economy with considerable deficit spending this year.
I think as economists, we can all understand the degree of uncertainty in forecasting at the moment. It's never been, I guess, more challenging to actually come up with a reasonable economic forecast. So I don't really blame them for not putting one on. Now, the other issue that's really been making attention at the moment is China and trade relationships. In Australia, we have seen some signs of a more fractured relationship between China and Australia. There's been issues with exports of meat and barley in particular. Now, obviously, China is Australia's number one trade destination. Close to 40% of our exports do go to China. The number one is iron ore, followed up by coal, LNG and education exports, which have been under pressure recently. Now, there's been, obviously, 2019, we saw a lot of news around the China-US trade relationship. What is actually happening there and what can we expect in 2020, particularly in the lead up to the presidential election in November this year?
Yes, so China's trading relationships have become more fraught, and it's not just with the US and Australia, it's also with other countries in the region, such as South Korea and Japan, for example. And I think some of these tensions reflect great power rivalries. And this rivalry between the US and China is not going to go away soon. So it's something that Australia and others in the region have just got to learn to live with. Now, it has sparked a public debate in Australia about diversifying our export markets, and that's going to be, I think, a useful debate to have. But our export markets aren't going to change rapidly. China is still going to be a very important part of Australia's economic future. It's, depending on how you measure it, the first or second largest economy in the world. It's still growing much more rapidly than other large economies. So it is going to be very important for Australia for quite a number of years to come. Now, in terms of what might happen this year, the US presidential election is less than 6 months away. It looks like President Trump, who is trailing his challenger, Joe Biden, in the polls, it looks like the president is going to use trade relationships as a bit of a political punching bag this year in the election campaign. So look, these issues are probably going to be more important for financial markets this year as we get closer to the November 3 US presidential election.
And certainly makes it even harder to forecast when we've got to deal with a COVID-safe economy as well. Appreciate your insights today, Joe, as always.
Thank you, Belinda.
Now, where CBA data is cited, this refers to the bank proprietary data. As the statistics take into account only the bank's data, it may not reflect all trends in the market. All customer data used or represented is anonymised and aggregated before analysis and is used and disclosed in accordance with the group's privacy policy statement. Now, you can find all the reports that we've been talking about on combankresearch.com.au.